Welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman, and I'm joined by Katie Balls and James Forsyth. And the big story that's dominating, I think, pretty much every front page this morning is the suspected poisoning of a Russian double agent in Salisbury. Katie, we're probably expecting some kind of statement or urgent question in Parliament on this today. What does this mean for British and Russian relations?
Well, everyone is at pains to point out that we don't know exactly what happened yet. But I think the general consensus is that if we have someone who once spied an enemy now of Russia taking a safe space in the UK, and they suddenly come down very ill and in a critical condition, is very unlikely to be a coincidence. Also adds into this backdrop we have, which is basically the worsening of relations between the UK and Russia. We know that this is the case when Boris Johnson met with the Russian government recently. I think their foreign minister said that relations were a very low point, and one of the lowest points, since the Cold War. And I think you're also seeing that with defence. We saw Gavin Williamson, I think, just yesterday raise the threat that Russia poses, pointing out that, Russia does not have the best interests of the West in its mind. And I think it really just adds to this feeling that perhaps when you look at things like defence, we do need to consider Russia as a threat to us rather than an ally.
There used to be an old KGB saying that any fool can commit murder, but it takes an artist to make it look like suicide. And I think one of the things that's striking about this case is, the parallels with the Litvinenko case, is the brazenness of it. There is no subtlety here. And I think that is designed to do two things. One, it is to send a message that Russia can do this, elements linked to the Russian state can do this. They can hunt these people down wherever they are in the world. And I think the second thing about it, which makes it so difficult for the UK government, is the risk that it poses to UK civilians. If you've got people, in the Litvinenko case, you had someone going into a sushi restaurant in central London with a radioactive substance. That obviously doesn't just endanger the health of the person that the Russians are trying to carry out a hit on, but that of lots of other people. And I think it is the brazenness that is the problem here. And I think one of the issues is, after the public inquiry into Litvinenko essentially established that the Russian state had been involved in his murder, the British response under the Cameron government, in which Theresa May was Home Secretary, was very weak. Not much was done. They basically said, well, we expelled a bunch of people previously about this, so we're not going to do anything more. You do actually need to take stronger and more decisive action. I also think that the other point that this brings on to is Katie's point about defence. You have Nick Timothy, the Prime Minister's former Chief of Staff, today warning in The Sun that basically essentially only half of the British Army can only deploy half of its strength because it's so low on kit, and essentially warning that it is simply not equipped to fight a land war with Russia. Now, we're obviously a long way away from that, but I think this kind of post-Cold War peace dividend that all Western democracies have thought that they had, we now need to accept that that is over. I mean, there's a remarkable fact that after Brexit, 80% of NATO spending will come from non-EU countries. I think right across Europe, given the turn in US policy and US politics post-Trump, everyone is going to have to be start spending a lot more money on defence.
Katie, what can the government realistically say if it is summoned to the chamber today, if a minister does have to answer an urgent question?
Well, I think they'll be reluctant to link this in a direct manner to the Russian government, partly because they will want to go probably through an investigation just as they did with Litvinenko before making such a claim. But obviously, I don't think they're going to try and pretend this is a completely innocent, accident. Someone ate something.
Yeah, it's hard to believe
by mistake.
That he just had some bad mozzarella on his pizza and Zizi.
Yeah, restaurant standards nowadays. So I think it's going to be difficult to strike a tone, but also I think they will be fairly comfortable being critical of Russia, because that is our current government stance. I don't think we have been particularly warm towards Russia. We have seen a deterioration in that relationship. But they will also want to, I think, not go so far as to accuse the Russian government of murdering someone on British soil or trying to kill them just yet.
So moving on, David Davis has got an appearance before the European Scrutiny Committee this afternoon. James, what are we expecting him to be questioned on?
Well, I think they're going to try and drill down, as they did with Philip Hammond yesterday, into the kind of details of where the Brexit talks are at, where preparations for no deal, which Theresa May has rebranded as preparations for every scenario, are, and what the kind of legal implications of the text are. I think one thing he should be pressed on is why the UK government haven't tried to provide their own legal text to interpret the December joint report. I mean, throughout this negotiation, the British government have been very slow at getting their own versions of texts or proposals out there, meaning that always what is being discussed is the EU's proposal. And in any negotiation, half the battle is getting your draft being the draft under discussion. So I think that is something that they would do well to push them on. I mean, there is also a question on the detail of lots of the stuff that Theresa May said in her speech on Friday and what it means. For example, when she was talking about aviation safety, she talked about how the Swiss courts get to interpret this in their own courts. But lots of people point out that the deal that allows the Swiss courts to do this is because the Swiss courts have essentially promised to follow the jurisprudence of the ECJ in making those decisions. So I expect the questions will be of that kind of slightly techie ilk.
And Katie, we're always hearing statistics about the number of air miles that DD has clocked up as he travels around meeting various European politicians. What might we hear from him today about the attitude of some European countries towards Brexit?
Well, we know that David Davis has been on this big charm offensive, along with several members of Theresa May's government, really, to try and meet with the EU member states and make their pitch that way, because they find the European Commission too ideological, and they think the best way to advance Britain's interests is to do that. We've seen one of Hungary's Secretary of State's basically broke rank and actually praised Theresa May's speech, the speech she made on Friday, and said that, you know, this was a good thing and, you know, Brussels should not try and punish Britain in the negotiations. Now, I don't think this is a huge surprise, because Hungary has always been one of Britain's allies probably in these EU negotiations. It's a country that's not ideologically attached to the EU, but I think it is again a sign of the tactics of the UK government beginning to work. I think the problem for David Davis, if he is asked questions on the approaches of the different member states, is that when it comes to the big decisions, you feel it's countries like Germany and France who have quite a big say on this, and I think is yet to be seen. Well, you haven't heard anything from them yet praising Theresa May's fantastic Brexit vision.
James, there's also a row going on with Martin Selmayr, who's one of the Brexit bogeymen.
Yes, this is Jean-Claude Juncker's extremely powerful chief of staff, who has a kind of prickly relationship with the Brussels press corps, I think would be probably the best way of putting it. And he has essentially got a massive promotion. And it all sounds a little bit suspicious, in that he essentially gets promoted to a job in the meeting, which qualifies him to apply for a job the next level up. He then immediately applies for that level up in the meeting itself and gets the job. And it all seems a bit like a stitch-up. And the French press, Libération, the French newspaper Libération, have been digging into this. And it now does appear that the Commission have misled people about the nature of the process, suggesting that other people had applied for the job when they hadn't, and so on and so forth. And I think this is one of those little stories that has the power to run and run and run. Because I was trying to think of a British equivalent to what has happened. And it is essentially akin to Margaret Thatcher on her way out of a door deciding that she was going to make Bernard Ingham the cabinet secretary. I mean, it is a quite remarkable act. And given that people have this view that Selmayr is essentially kind of in control of Jean-Claude Juncker, that Juncker who is not a kind of control freak or an attention to details kind of guy, it is the perfect front man for Selmayr. I think it is going to kind of carry on this, and I think also the press are going to keep digging, because he has almost as many enemies in the Brussels press corps as Damien McBride had in the Westminster press corps when he was Gordon Brown's when he was spinning for Gordon Brown.
Katie, what might this mean for the Brexit negotiations?
But I don't think Martin Sommer has ever been seen as a friend of Britain in these negotiations. I think a lot of the leaks of... I was going to say one dinner, but I think it's actually more than one between Theresa May and Juncker, were kind of the blame was pointed in his direction as someone who could be responsible for what was quite a vicious leak. So I think his dominance is never really in Britain's interests within the commission. If these things are highlighted, then that could be good. But I don't think it really has that much direct effect on the negotiations.
I think the only way in which it would have a direct effect on the negotiations is if this scandal kind of metastasized out of control. And you have Bruno Waterfield, the Times' Brussels correspondent, speculating as to whether this could end up in a kind of Jacques Santer-style situation where the entire commission had to resign because of this. I think we're quite a way off that. Obviously, if something like that happened, it would essentially kind of reset the process. But I think it is worth watching as a story, certainly.
Thank you, James, and thank you, Katie. And you can listen to this podcast, Coffeehouse Shots, on the iTunes store. You can also subscribe to my free Evening Blend email, which is a roundup and analysis of the day's politics. Just go to spectator.co.uk/eveningblend. Thanks for listening.